From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on a frigid Rochester night, January 1993. Masked gunmen broke into the Rochester Brinks Depot and executed one of the top five armored car heists in history at the time. They escaped with $7.4 million, most of which still has never been found. That robbery was the center for a tangled web with seemingly countless strands that led in just about every direction. Who was responsible? Why did the trail seem to lead to Northern Ireland? What was the connection to the IRA? Who knew about this? Was it an inside job? For years, we've wanted all of the answers. And while we haven't gotten every single one of them yet, Democrat and Chronicle reporter Gary Craig gives us a gripping narrative of the heist and the investigation in his new book. It's called 7 Million, a cop, a priest, a soldier for the IRA, and the still unsolved Rochester Brinks heist. Gary promised he would answer all of the remaining questions when he came on Connections. Thank you for doing that.
Oh, yes. I'm glad to help. No, I didn't tell you the book is the ultimate red herring, right?
Congratulations.
Oh, thanks, Evan.
So, Gary, let's get the praise out of the way here first, because I know you sort of hate this stuff, but I'm going to tell you. You did a fabulous job. The book is gripping from the first page. It does read like a novel. It happens to not be a novel. It's a real life. But it just it is remarkable how much work. I can't even conceive of how you decided to pull this into a book. But it's fabulous. Congratulations on that.
I really appreciate that. Thank you.
And I know you've had reporting that goes back for many years on this that helped form the basis of this. But when was this a book in your mind?
You know, it's odd in that I covered the arrests of the folks who were accused of the crime, the robbery in 93, and then I was actually doing politics and stuff then, but I just ended up being somebody sent down to New York for that. And a couple of years later, such a fascinating cast of characters. I did a couple of chapters. A friend, Bill Klaus, was a federal public defender, and he's one of the attorneys in the books, and I used the federal court transcripts and stuff. And then just put it on a shelf. I did probably two chapters, and the first ones were very similar, actually, to what I wrote then. And put it on a shelf and forgot about it until... So 1996, we learn about this missing guy, Ronnie Gibbons, who had been loosely connected to the robbery. He wasn't involved, but he was involved in the planning. And he had come to Rochester the year before looking for what he believed should be his cut of the money.
And he wanted a cut.
He did. And you know, it was a very bad decision. And his remains weren't found. Well, they were found earlier, but weren't identified until 2011. And I really got close to Ronnie's family through those years, and sort of my main goal was to try to help them locate Ronnie, and we all believed him to be dead, and he was. But so once Ronnie's remains were found and identified in the investigation, you know, it was sort of still looking at that part of it, his murder, then I said, you know, there's this, why not pull this back off the shelf again? And with my organizational skills, I was surprised I actually had those chapters and I knew where they were. I figured they were gone, you know, and I would just have to start from scratch. But they were on a shelf.
It was fate. Once you found them on the shelf, you had to write
that.
The rest
that was
of it.
That was pretty much it. I said, now I have no choice. I can't turn back.
Gary mentioned before the hour began that the book could have been hundreds of pages more simply because of some of the conversations he's had with people like Father Pat, who we're going to talk about. But he condensed it into 250, 260 pages or so in this gripping narrative. And we are going to talk a little bit about the process, because there will be moments when you read 7 Million and you go, how did he get that? How did he know that? Where did that quote come from? And there are these delicious moments of just the reporting is fantastic. Some of it comes from, he says, court transcripts. And in many cases, you had great sources who told you some great detail, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of addressed it in the book when I kind of talk a little bit about the process in the book near the end or at the end. And I did. I had, admittedly, sources on all sides of this. I mean, I had on the criminal side, on the law enforcement side. And some are, I mean, you know, there's obviously this IRA connection, which I write about. I talk to folks who serve prison time with the IRA. So, yeah, there's, I think everybody that I talk to who would allow it, I note in the book at the end when I'm doing acknowledgments. There were a number of folks, yeah, probably a handful, who didn't want to be identified. And I think in every case, they were people that I sought out because I knew of their knowledge, but they had the reasons not to be identified.
Believe it or not, we're not that far away from beach reading time. This is not an airy, breezy thing, but trust me, if you're looking for summer reading, you want to get going on it, you're going to pick up 7 Million and you probably won't put it down. Gary Craig is my guest, the author of the book 7 Million. He's got some events coming up. What do you got coming up, by the way?
Barnes & Noble Pittsford on Saturday at 1 p.m. And then I'm at the one out at RIT at 4 p.m. And then from there, I'm doing Webster, Greece, couple in Buffalo. But if you look me up on my professional Facebook page, which if I knew the name, I would tell you right now, but I'll find it by the end.
This is the best. Every time Gary's on, he's the worst self-promoter. The single worst I've ever had. I had Gary on as one of our guests talking about their favorite books of 2016. And I said, by the way, you're working on a book. What's it called? And Gary went, oh, I should probably know that. I'm going, you're publishing this book in a few months and you don't even know the title.
It is an unwieldy title, in my defense.
But, I'm going to tell you again the title. This is why Gary couldn't get it. 7 million. What's the subtitle? I'm going to quiz you now. No, look at it.
I do know without looking at it. A cop, a priest, a soldier for the IRA, and the still unsolved Rochester Brinks heist.
All right. Gary is our guest here. The book is out now. You can get it at Barnes & Noble. You can get it online. It's other places people should.
Pretty much Barnes & Noble's throughout the county have them. Webster, Greece, RIT, Pittsford. Amazon has it out in Buffalo. I know both shops there. I'm going to be doing Amherst and McKinley Mall, and so I know they're out there too. Yes.
Okay. And so let's talk about the event here, because what I found when I got ready for the program, even talking to people in this newsroom, it's easy to forget over the years some of the details, and it's a fascinating story. Gary starts us off right away, takes us inside the depot. Now, people knew the armored trucks. Most people did not know where there was a depot on South Ave. So tell us about what the depot was and kind of give us that setting that you kind of opened the book with there.
Sure. I mean, I think when most people hear of the robbery, they think, oh, an armored truck was robbed. Actually, no, the depot, and it was this little really nondescript little building, which is still there, and I think a car repair shop now, right outside the inner loop on South Ave if you're going out. And basically, millions and millions of dollars, one night of the week, sometimes tens of millions, were there that they would be shipped in. Brinks, it was a Brinks depot, and it had been for a number of years by 93. They'd be shipped in often from there was then a Federal Reserve operation in Buffalo. I don't believe it's there any longer. And basically, this was sort of a hub where the money would get shipped there, and banks in the area and the city and the suburbs would have made their orders for how much money they think they might need, cash on hand for the coming weeks. And basically, there would be folks in there counting out the money and divvying it out and go out to the banks the next day. But so typically at night, the money would get there in late afternoon from, typically the Federal Reserve, and it would just sit there, it'd be counted, divided up for wherever it was going, and it would sit there overnight and then taken out to those locations the next day.
Like any great reporter, that's not even true. Like many great reporters, Gary has great sources and a lot of great detail, but not every great reporter is a great writer. Gary is a great writer. He gives every character that you meet in this book a personality, from Milt Deal. You say Deal?
Yeah, who's sadly deceased now, but I had we had court transcripts and depositions and other things. And his family, actually, there's I didn't know, for instance, I would not have known he was a marksman at D-Day. Which is just a passing reference to that, had I not talked to his son, who was tremendously helpful. And that was just, that's just one little mention in the book about that, where I note that, he had this past of heroism in World War II when he was very young, actually. But he was smart enough not to draw a gun when these folks came in and to rob the depot.
Yep, Dick Popovich, another one of the guards. So these are the guards you meet right off the bat here. And you do get some personality, some color with these guys. What they were doing was any run-of-the-mill night. It was them along with a retired cop, Mr. O'Connor.
Tom O'Connor.
And they were just doing what they always do, which is counting the money, recounting it, getting it set. Popovich had devised a nice little system for them, so they were trying to get out of there for the night. They were trying to get back to their families, and take us through what happened on that night.
Yeah, I mean, those were the three, Dick Popovich, Milt Deal, Tom O'Connor. They were counting the money to be delivered to the banks the next day. And basically, Tom O'Connor had gone out to bring in some, some more canvas bags for loading the money. And Milt Deal and Dick Popovich are basically confronted by these armed gunmen.
One of the guards thought this was a joke at first, right?
Yeah, I mean, that was, Milton Deal, when you read the transcripts, basically, there's court transcripts mentions that at first he thought this was some bizarre sort of, which would be a really weird, because it could lead to trouble, obviously, but some sort of bizarre test that Brinks was doing. But obviously, he realized very quickly it wasn't.
No, and so both of those guys, Dick and Milt, were smart enough not to resist. They wanted to preserve their lives, and Gary kind of takes us through those moments where they get kind of tied up. They're on the ground, wondering if they're about to be killed. And they're trying to listen to the sounds around them, which was a smart thing to do as well there, because all of a sudden the mundanities become much more profound that you're listening to, the sounds that you would hear every day, the sounds of tires and those kinds of things. The whole robbery didn't take too long, though, right,
Gary? If they're probably out of there in 20-some minutes, I would think, yeah.
Okay, and the question, you know, the reader is going to have, and the question that I'm sure Milton Dick had was, well, where's Tom O'Connor? What happened?
Yeah, well, that's so...
The third guard.
Exactly. So basically, as they're tied up and ultimately put sort of side by side. They weren't in the same room when they were first, you know, basically overtaken. And you know, Dick hears Milt Deal say something, so he realizes that you know, Milton is there. And then, you know, one of the robbers says, you know, we've got your buddy or something like that. I don't remember the exact words. And so they then realize that...
Call the police and we'll kill him.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, Tom O'Connor, they realize they've got Tom O'Connor. And so when, you know, Popovich is able to sort of maneuver himself free, and they call 911, and, you know, cops arrive, and Tom is gone. I use first names. I've been writing this so long.
You knew some of them. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, he ultimately ends up, you know, dropped off. He was, you know, by his account, taken hostage and dropped off at a restaurant that he'd frequented before near there, close enough that he knew, you know, where to go. And so ultimately, you know, they all end up thankfully alive and well.
But... $7.4 million is gone. There are instantly questions about how in the world robbers could get in. And it didn't really help the Brinks Depot's case that the door itself, you said you could just put a shoulder on the door and push hard and that thing would open. That's not great security for a place that's holding tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah, there was testimony to that. And also, I mean, even if they had secured that well, there was testimony that, you know, the guards themselves, some of them had gotten a little bit lax and would allow folks to sort of come in. I think there was a story, you know, there is a story in the book mentioned just in passing about a girlfriend who comes in, you know, with a check or something, and a guy who delivers a pizza. And
they turn around and they're like, oh, the pizza guy's in the vault.
Exactly.
Like, how did he get in here?
So, you know, so it had gotten a little lax the way they were handling it. And there were, you know, Dick Popovich talks about he had raised issues about some of the security measures with Brinks and was unhappy with the response he was getting. And that became, you know, Tom O'Connor ultimately is accused of being the inside guy with the robbery and is acquitted at trial. But his major defense at trial was, you know, this claim that this place was ripe for a robbery, and, you know, which his lawyer, Felix Lapine, I think, has termed it a cheese box or something. But
yes. I like that, cheese box. Yes. So anybody could have robbed it. You know, it doesn't
exactly have
to be the IRA, right? It doesn't have to be. Tom doesn't have. You don't need an inside job to rob this yeah. depot. But Gary also has a great quote in there. I was asking before the hour. I said, "How did you get this quote?" One of the cops that very night when they were investigating, apparently said to, I guess maybe it said in passing to another cop, if Tom O'Connor isn't dead, he did it. How did you get that quote?
Yeah, that was, there's a reason there's not a name attached to that one.
But, yeah.
You know, that was...
Do you want to break any news here?
Exactly. That, you know, that was somebody who knew I was working on the book and was in this room with cops, you know, when this happened. And you know, basically, you know, this was not Tom O'Connor's first brush with the law. He had been a suspect. He was never sort of publicly identified as a suspect, but I don't think it's a reach to say he was, in a homicide from a few years before, or at Genesee Brewery Warehouse, where he'd been working security. And, you know, and he, to this day, there are folks with the Forks who are defenders of Tom O'Connor. He's deceased now. Defenders of Tom O'Connor believe he, you know, got a bad rap for some things. And there are those who, you know, would still never trust him regardless.
Well, he was a guy who had a history. Yep. So let's go back, because Tom O'Connor is arguably the most important person in this book, because if he was involved, he was the inside guy, and yep. He did have these connections that go back to the IRA. So on the outside, he is this sort of red-haired, pretty jovial guy, though many of the people apparently who work with him didn't ever feel like they really knew him. He was this jovial guy, but what you might not have known was his real support for the IRA, right?
Yeah, he, you know, and there's one thing I have to admit, I'm not sure if I ever truly got a firm grip on it of how much this was something that had been, you know, part of his interior fiber, you know, as, you know, with this Irish heritage for a long time, or if it's something that grew out of the circles he traveled in, including even girlfriends who were very active in it. But nonetheless, he you know, he becomes very important. Obviously, one is, you know, the alleged inside guy, and two, as, you know, the person who smuggles Sam Miller into the country, who, you know, had been in prison for IRA crimes, and we know definitely pulled off the robbery, not only because he was convicted of it, because he wrote a book about it. So there was no question that Sam Miller was the robber, and Tom was his buddy who smuggled him into the country to help get him out of Belfast.
So the guy who ends up writing the book, and we're going to get into Sam's book a little bit later too, and some of Gary's thoughts on that. But Tom O'Connor in the mid 1980s smuggles him into this country, and I think it's valuable as well to kind of remind us what was really going on with the IRA at the time. Because again, we got to go back a little bit here. Northern Ireland, there's this view of, you know, want separation from British rule, and these there were questions on whether NORAD, what exactly that stands for?
Northern Ireland. Oh my gosh, it'll come to me later.
It's essentially it's aid for Northern Ireland, yeah, assistance for Northern Ireland. Exactly.
Thank you. Yes. You think after writing the book, I would remember these things?
Right. So anyway, there's these little chapters in cities like Boston and New York City and Rochester. They were raising money ostensibly for the families of imprisoned IRA fighters. And there were questions about whether they actually supported violence. And some people who supported Northern Irish independence clearly did not want violence.
Right.
Others didn't care. Others viewed it as, this is freedom fighting. These rebels are heroes. And Tom O'Connor was where on that scale?
Oh, he was. I mean, I think he probably definitely fit into the latter category. I mean, originally, and I noted in the book a little, there was this sort of two kind of factions in Rochester, which obviously has a very big Irish-American population. And some of those were sort of a faction that was, you know, truly more pacifist in their belief about the way things should be resolved. And NORAD was more, I mean, I don't want to say militant really, but, you know, but they were sometimes seen as supporters of a more violent resolution of things. Not that, you know, again, because they believed it was, you know, freedom fighters doing the job. And ultimately, I guess, yeah, NORAD sort of became the lone operation here. There's testimony in some of the trials about how, you know, if you wanted to be part of this, you had to join NORAD because the other sort of disappeared as the years went on.
So
it was a very active chapter here.
All right, so there's the backdrop. So why did police think Tom O'Connor might be involved here? Why did one of those officers give Gary that great quote where they said from the beginning, if he's not dead, he did it? Because Tom O'Connor brought in to this country Sam Miller. We're going to talk about Sam Miller in a second, who had been an imprisoned rebel,
yes,
and had obviously gone through a lot for the cause. And this was a time when NORAD and other chapters, yes, they're raising money ostensibly for the families, but the question that investigators had, hard to prove, but a long suspicion was, that money might not be going to the families. It might be going to buy arms, to buy weaponry that is increasingly sophisticated. And you had awful incidents. You had bombings and issues with other weaponry, civilians unfortunately occasionally killed. And so investigators wanted to know, is this money funding the purchase of that? Well, Tom O'Connor, this retired cop who supports the IRA, brought in Sam Miller to this country in the mid-80s. Now he's working as a guard at Brinks. It's logical to wonder. Maybe he saw that $7+ million as a great way to go help the IRA, right?
Yeah, and the amazing thing about this case, I mean, there's so many weird twists with this case, but the very night of the robbery, an FBI, you know, Special Agent Bill Dillon, who, you know, still lives in the area and was actually a Ronnie Court supervisor for a while, had been involved in the search for Miller in the mid-80s and just, I think I just know in the book, just like barely missed him one time. I mean, there was still tea on the
counter. There was tea on the counter, tea on the stove.
Yeah,
that's
how close they were. And that night, you know, he didn't know for sure, but they knew for sure that Tom O'Connor had smuggled Sam into the country. He didn't know for sure that Sam was involved in the robbery, but he basically put out this theory that said, look, you know, if you think Tom was involved, and many did, you should maybe try to find Sam Miller. And then, of course, another thing that helps with that is later they had this sort of look at tire track imprints on the floor there. You know, they sort of did this work and figured out perhaps what kind of vans it might be, and turned out that Sam's wife, they found out, was driving a van that was a perfect match. So when that all came together, they really then wanted to find Sam.
All right, so they're looking for Sam Miller, and I want you to, you know, broadly speaking, let me tell the listeners again, Gary and I could get into a lot of weeds here, and the weeds are the really fun, juicy parts of this book, by the way. You're going to love the reporting and the way Gary's compiled the book. The book's called 7 Million. You can get it now. But if I got into the weeds, we'd have to be here all day. Yes. So we're going to kind of keep it as broad as we can. But they're looking for Sam Miller. And I really appreciated the fact that you kind of – I think there's one moment where you tell the readers that, you know, the work of tailing someone,
yes,
it's quite an art. And sometimes trailing by vehicle, for example, they'll trade off who's doing the trailing, you know, so the person who's getting trailed doesn't necessarily recognize it. There's a real art to it. And they did some things pretty well here. So why don't you kind of take us through the process that led up, you know, over the ensuing months there?
Sure. I mean, they actually locate Sam and his family in Queens and through a number of sort of investigative means there. And he doesn't really, you know, he lives just probably a mile or two. Well, he has, in the beginning when they find him, you know, they basically find where he lives and they're tailing him there and to some other spots. They have three kids. They're doing all kinds of domestic stuff. Neither he nor his wife seem to have work. They didn't have work. And
it's almost like they're sitting on a pile of money.
Exactly. Go figure. And so they tell him about, and then what happens is the first World Trade Center bombing. So basically, you know, every other investigation in New York that can be suspended is suspended. And the investigation into this one is one of them. And then ultimately, an FBI special agent here, months and months and months have passed, and they've made the arrest in the World Trade Center bombing. And their, you know, the lead agent here, Paul Hawkins, is hoping to get the case up and going again, and makes a plea, and sure enough, they do. And this is when they go back, and you know, there were fears that if he had been involved, the money's gone. But instead, they pretty much find him moving the money, basically going to an apartment in Manhattan, and then they see this guy Father Pat hanging out with him. They do some background on Father Pat, and there's this previous IRA related charge there, which charges were dropped. I'll note, but yes.
And if I remember correctly, one of the things they were trying to do was track down Bernadette, his wife's,
yes,
vehicles and what she owns. And it turns out she's driving a vehicle that she didn't buy, that Father Patrick Maloney, yeah, bought.
Yes.
And they're going, well, who's, you know, what's the connection here? And the priest becomes quite a central player here. So tell us about Father Pat.
Yeah, so they have this information that Father Pat had bought this, you know, very expensive Explorer for the, you know, the Miller family, and they were driving it. And they were looking into that sum, and then basically, you know, Father Pat starts showing up. Oh, I should note, too, that Sam at this point was running a comic book store in Queens.
I love it. There's a line where you say the terrorist loved comic books.
He did. He's, I mean, from his childhood on, he was just aficionado of comic books.
All the investigators are like, well, where's Sam Miller? He's probably down at the comic book shop.
Exactly. No, it was, and you know, at the time of the arrest, I was at that store, and it was such a strange sort of symmetry there.
Yeah.
But And so then Father Pat starts showing up at the comic store and then ultimately is making the trip to this apartment in Manhattan where they believe basically based on what these guys weren't particularly, you know, smooth with what they were doing. I mean, if Father Pat went into this carrying what the investigator believed to be a money counter, Sam was carrying bags. I think his one agent told me, he said he still can't believe that he's carrying these sort of nylon bags where you could see the edges of cash instead of something much larger where it wasn't easy to, you know, wouldn't have been easy to tell what he was carrying. And so obviously once they see Father Pat in these circles as well as buying the Explorer, they basically say, we've got to do some research on this guy.
Okay. And the whole time this is happening, where is the retired cop in Rochester, Tom O'Connor?
You know, he's... Yeah, basically, you know, there's no proof really from the night of the robbery to this point where that connects him to the movement of the money downstage. You know, he's not seen with Sam, or though he obviously knew Sam, they were friends. He's not seen with Father Pat. I mean, Father Pat did a talk at a NORAID event here where Tom was, but there's no proof that they actually knew each other. But obviously the suspicions, especially once they spotted Sam with the money, what they believed to be the money. Then obviously, given Tom and Sam's relationship, you know, the belief is that Tom must have been the inside guy. They believed it from the night of, but that had further proof for them.
Dan writes the program and says, definitely going to get the book. Want to know, could they track the money with serial numbers?
That, I get a little bit into this in the early chapters.
Yeah.
There was, out of the $7.4 million, perhaps surprisingly, there was only, I forgot, 100,000, 200,000 that was new. This was new sort of fit cash is what they called it. I'm forgetting my terms here, but I should read my own book. But and basically had this new crisp cash, which they knew the serial numbers on. And But it was there was all this old cash, too, which is cycled through so many places that they really, when it hits the Federal Reserve again, it comes back there. And it's just sort of this mix and match of old and new money going out. And so they knew the new cash that had been sent out. So they at least had serial numbers there when they found money to say this is some of it. But the large, I don't know, 95%+ or more of the money, they did not know the serial numbers of.
All right, so that wasn't an easy way to track it. But now they've got their read on Father Pat and Sam Miller and his family, and they eventually are going to have to make a move here.
Yes.
What happened?
Well, so they ultimately, you know, when they become convinced by the money counter, by the fact that these folks seem to have unusual cash to spend, by going to the sneaking up to the apartment one night and hearing what they believed to be the money counter spitting out cash inside the apartment in Manhattan, that they need to move, especially when they believed it was being counted. And as I think somebody with the FBI says in there, you know, once they believed to be counted, they felt they really had to move because they thought it may be shipped somewhere. So they get what's known as a sneak and peek warrant. That's sort of the vernacular for it. And which, you know, different than sort of the typical search warrant we hear about where people go in and seize things. The sneak and peek, basically, you go in, you can look, you can touch, but you're not removing. And so they get that and they go in, and sure enough, they find lots of cash, two point some million in the apartment, and they find a good match. You know, they find some that match the serial numbers, some of the new cash. So obviously they knew then this was the Brinks money. And then once they've done that, then obviously they get the warrant to make the arrest and go back for the full search and seize the money.
Did they think at the time, well, this is, the dam is broken. We're going to get all $7+ million back now.
Oh, yeah. I think they definitely believed, well, to a degree.
I mean, some of it could have been spent, but
exactly.
You know, they felt like maybe they were on...
Because this is really only months later. I mean, you're talking the fall of 93 and the robberies January 93. And though I do think they had suspicions that some had maybe made its way to Northern Ireland. But yeah, I think they expected to get much more. $2 million was nice, but you know, the other $5 million has still never been accounted for.
So they found $2+ million with Sam Miller. The other $5 million still never been found. Gary claims he's not sitting on it.
I know, as I note in the book, some of the investigators joke that I know the location, but trust
if
me,
anybody
trust
would,
me, I
you
don't.
Would, man. If anybody would, it'd be you.
I wish that were true.
Bob in Rochester has a question for you, though.
Yes.
So let's go to Bob. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi, I'm literally sitting in the parking lot looking at the building, the scene of the crime.
I love that. Thank you.
Had lunch up in South Avenue, so I drove down. So let me first get what humble people don't want to hear. But first of all, anybody listening, go buy the book. That's number one.
Yeah.
It's a perfect storm that for the author, for any author of this book, but particularly for Gary. Perfect storm is he's an exceptional writer, as Evan, you said. The investigative reporter in him comes out all over the place. And Gary's a very humble, and I think you are too, Evan, extraordinary storyteller, real story, real people, and a remarkable ability to have personal connections, real connections with people I think both of you need, and yet this incredible ability to still be able to step back, be objective journalist. So I'm sorry to make that so painful for you, Gary.
thank you, Bob. I appreciate
that. I have a question, finally. If you were to guess, given everything you've done, what's the rest of the story? And I know you don't have it. But what is the rest of the story? And this, if you were to guess, where's the money? Where's the rest of the money?
Yeah, I mean, with the book, as you know, I'm very cautious, and I have some conjecture in there. You know, I think there were a number of people involved, despite Sam Miller's book, which claims to the contrary, and they would have gotten a cut and they would have divided it up. And so right away, you know, the $7 million becomes much smaller shares when you're dividing it up. And, you know, if you sit on it and find ways to spend it and you're cautious, you know, maybe you can, you know, make a lifetime out of the money. So I think right there, a number of folks, you know, had their hands in it and probably walked away with some shares that will probably never be found. You know, Northern Ireland is the bigger issue. I think the book will say, and this was from talking to people with the IRA and talking to others who studied the IRA for years, the belief that the IRA was sort of the puppeteer mastermind of this is probably wrong. It didn't really match anything the IRA did. That said, you know, you had people whose sympathies were with the IRA, so I think a much more believable premise is that some of the money may have made its way to Northern Ireland just because of their sympathies, that they may have known ways to get it there. Not that the IRA said, go rob this depot for the money, but they said, hey, let's rob this depot, and while we're at it, let's maybe send some to the IRA. Mm.
That answer, what do you think, Bob?
It's a good thing. Yeah, that adds to what you, like you said, Gary, hints at what's in the book. Yes. And I'm sort of relieved because I'm now outside looking at the vent and the chimney that sticks up, so I shouldn't try to climb up there.
No, my goodness, no.
Trust me, there's none of it is at the depot. That I can say for sure.
Okay.
Bob.
So congratulations on a phenomenal book, and thank you very much.
Bob,
thank you. That's a lovely phone call. But by the way, Bob, I'm sure that door, if you really want to get in, just lean hard on it. Apparently,
exactly.
It's pretty easy to bust in there. I'm not sure you're going to find any cash, though. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back, and there's a lot more I want to talk about with Gary Craig about his book, 7 Million, A Cop, A Priest, A Soldier for the IRA, and the Still Unsolved Rochester Brinks Heist. We have some sound that you're going to get to hear the voice of Father Pat Maloney, because the New York Times did a piece on the man, by the way, they called him. What did they call him in that story there? They called Father Pat, oh boy, I had the note somewhere here. Anyway, it was a pretty colorful thing, but of course I've lost it. But
He is surely colorful.
I want to talk more about because you've had plenty of conversations
with Father Pat.
And we're going to hear him in his own voice. We're going to talk to Gary about that. We're going to talk to Gary about how much conjecture he decided to include in the book. Because if you look at what Sarah Koenig and the Serial crew did when they were covering the Adnan Syed case, and that became this big podcast, a lot of people wanted her to wrap it up with, what do you think happened? Mm-hmm. And she sort of did. And I want to ask Gary how much pressure he felt to include or not include what he actually thought about Tom O'Connor, where the money is, who was involved and not. So we'll talk about that and a lot more with Gary when we come back from this break. And I will tell you what's coming up Wednesday on The Next Connections. We're going to sit down with Captain Ronald Johnson of the Missouri State Highway Patrol. He was selected to coordinate law enforcement agencies during the protests in Ferguson immediately following the death of Michael Brown. We're going to talk to him about his work, the lessons he learned in those tense moments, and his views on similar situations across the country. That's tomorrow. All right. Thank you to producer Megan Mack for bailing me out there. The New York Times article on Father Pat is A Priest Unafraid of Trouble. And Gary said,
oh, that's definitely Father Pat. He is, yes. Trouble sometimes finds him, but he's not afraid of it.
But he always seemed to have an answer.
Yes.
You know, and before we hear some of the sound that they collected for that, to kind of hear him in his own voice, you said that every time you talked to him, he had a pretty detailed explanation for every question.
Yeah, I mean, and I've been down to Father Pat's place in the Lower East Side a couple of times, and and I've talked to him about some of the events, and the last time was really more in phone calls to talk to him more about his time in prison.
What did you do, 3 or 4 years or something?
Yeah, about that. Yeah, up in or down in Loretto, and there's some about that in the book. And I actually visited him when he was at Loretto. That was the first time, well, other than the trial, but the first time I sort of had a long sit down with him. He was actually in prison at Loretto.
How did you find him to be?
The guy is a fascinating character. I mean, he's charming as can be. He does wear his sympathies on his sleeve. He's been a longtime fighter for the impoverished, folks in need, and it's I believe truly genuine. And he can talk. He can. I think, as I was telling you, it's when I go to his place, it's going to be tough if I have like 15 questions I need to ask him, because I'm probably going to get through two or three.
Yeah.
And I think in the book, I note that, he proclaims his innocence. The jury found otherwise. I lay out during the trial and some of the stuff before the trial what the evidence was. I have him countering some of that. And, if I talked to him bit by bit, again, as I said, the book would have been hundreds of pages longer. But I think the book notes that the jury found one way, he claims the other, and folks can decide as they wish.
Let's listen to what Father Pat told the New York Times about the Rochester Brinks heist.
Well, the first thing I'd like to emphasize is I was never at any time charged with the actual Brinks robbery. A year after the robbery had taken place, I was arrested and charged with attempted possession of money, allegedly, that came from the Brinks. Now, to answer your question quite directly, originally, the FBI and the powers that be in Rochester claimed that it was a job done by mob or mafia or what have you. It would have been the fifth largest robbery in the United States, the other four being unsolved. And if I may say so, this one is also unsolved. And they needed a scapegoat. They were able to tie me to a political activity, social activity, and work for social justice on behalf of Irish rebel refugees and others. And in my personal opinion, created a case totally on circumstantial evidence. I emphasize, I had nothing whatever to do with the Brinks robbery. I gained nothing whatever from it then or even up to now. So I feel I was just a well-known, or if you like, now that I consider myself that prestigious, excellent scapegoat.
There's Father Pat. You've heard that all before, right?
Yeah, and I just, hearing the voice, I love it. I'm sorry. I've spent so many hours with the fellow and talking to him on the phone too. And I just, it's been a while since I've spoken to him. So just hearing the voice sort of warms my heart.
But Gary, yes. You know, he's saying, you know, didn't have anything to do with it. You know, I'm the scapegoat. He's carrying a money counter and hanging out with Sam Miller. What's the explanation for that?
Yeah, that, I mean, one thing, there has been no proof of him connected to the robbery. And I think even in Sam's book, he goes to pains to say Father Pat was not involved in the robbery. Obviously, the issue, and that's why he wasn't charged with the robbery. The issue becomes, why is he going in and out of the place that has the $2 million from the Brinks heist and has the money counter and some other things, you know, that they believed has 180 some thousand in his Lower East Side place when that's searched and raided the day of the arrest.
Which he says he's just helping his flock with.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, basically. And it's true. He helped a lot of illegal immigrants through the years. And he claimed that he was a bank for them and sort of saved their money. There was another rationale at trial, which I think I note in the book, kind of was born during the trial when his attorneys found out that Sam Miller had worked at some illegal casinos in New York City, and it kind of gave them this, oh, well, maybe this was money from the casinos, because yeah, if he believed the money to be from something else, even if illegal, he couldn't be convicted of conspiracy to possess the Brinks cash, the money from the robbery. And so that sort of became this theory put forth at trial, but it was clearly born during the trial. And I think, as I say, it was sort of a Hail Mary effort to try to come up with something to explain his nearness to all this money.
A Hail Mary effort for
yes,
a priest?
Like, exactly. How could I not say that?
So I would ask you, you know, how much you believe him, but I want to ask you first, how much you chose as the author of this book and as the reporter and as a journalist to include your own conjecture. You know, I mean, you have your own opinions.
Yes.
And you've given, you know, certainly some of that. But how much did you want to? How much did you include? How much did you wrestle with that question?
You know, I include some of my conjecture, but not a lot. And I think that's probably, and I have to admit, there are sort of books through the years I've read that are true crime where, you know, the conjecture, I think, even if to point sort of, I become skeptical of it. And it's maybe it's because of the job I do where I conjecture is not what I do. I mean, I do personally in my head, but at least what I'm writing, you know, on a daily basis is not what I'm doing. And I think that sort of carried over to the book. Well, so I put some theories out there at the end of the book. And based on reporting, I personally think I was probably restrained. As a matter of fact, to the point where, like, one friend who read the epilogue where I get into this said, man, aren't you being really cautious? I said, yeah, but it's kind of the way I feel about it.
Do you want to add anything that you didn't add in the book right here?
No,
this is
I mean,
chance, Gary.
You know, I mean, I will say that, and I don't even think I said this in the book, but I will say, when I write about the homicide of Ronnie Gibbons,
yeah,
and I note that, you know, that the people I believe that know how he died were the ones he came to see here in Rochester, which, and they're all deceased, it was the late Tom O'Connor and two brothers, Cale and Liam McGee. I note why I believe that, other than just the fact that that's who he was coming to see in Rochester, as evidence showed. But I will say that I have other reasons to believe that I didn't put in the book, because there was no way to write it without identifying who told it to me.
Okay.
And I had promised I wouldn't do that. Yes.
And protecting sources is still at the core of what you do.
Exactly. Yes.
And, yeah. So. And you developed a lot of sources for this book. Okay. Well, you know, there's so many other things I could ask you about. We haven't talked much about Gibbons, and that's probably unfortunate. But let me just kind of remind our listeners, for Tom O'Connor, Gary mentioned earlier, but, you know, he was acquitted at trial.
He was acquitted at trial, yes.
So was that a surprise at the time, Gary?
You know, I think so. He had Felix Opinion is a brilliant lawyer, so I think that helped. And, you know, and as I was writing, I thought about this. I mean, I have sat in on trials where, and watched them, where I said, you know, I believe the person did this, but if I were on the jury, I probably would have acquitted because either the evidence, it doesn't meet the threshold, the burden of proof, or the investigation was just sloppy. And Felix did a really great job, I think, of poking holes in the prosecution case by showing, again, the vulnerabilities of the depot.
Okay. And I also am curious to know how your police sources appreciated or didn't appreciate the fact that you kind of laid bare some of the rivalry that local police sometimes have with the feds.
Oh, yes.
You know, you kind of gave us that color right out of the gate there. That and we see that in many high profile cases where, you know, it's a local investigation until it isn't.
Yes.
That happened there, didn't it? You had that tension.
Well, there was a lot going on at that time. I mean, you had this civil rights investigation into Rochester police, which led, you know, later to acquittals at trial. But, you know, that was the FBI. You had another major armored car heist, which
the AMSA case.
Yeah, which some would argue that the FBI had bungled. I perhaps argued that in the book.
I think you said it straight out that they bungled it.
I mean, and so you had this sort of friction sort of ongoing there. But ultimately, when push came to shove, you know, Paul Hawkins, who's now retired, was, you know, they actually set up shop with the RPD and welcomed him. And then I think they ultimately were able to collaborate well. And a lot of it obviously happened downstate, you know, where the investigation was going there. But yeah, there, you know, it's funny. I am waiting to hear from some of the folks with the FBI and RPD about those parts of the book. So I'm waiting to hear what they say.
What else have people who are not deceased, who are in the book, what have you heard from them since the publication?
Oh, it's been nice. I mean, I've only talked to a handful that probably really know the story firsthand, but they've all been, you know, very positive, which is nice, and, you know, haven't pointed out any glaring errors to me. So that's always.
And here's a fascinating thing. I mean, somewhere out there in this community, first of all, the next time you get change wherever you are, you may be getting Brink's dollars handed to you. It's possible. And somewhere out there may be people who have even more information. And Gary started this blog. You ended up getting more information than you thought. Tell us the story of the blog and what happened.
You know, after, again, you know, this guy Ronnie Gibbons, who disappears and his remains are found in 2011, and I had gotten to know the family and I, you know, reported on the robbery early, I sort of came up with this idea of this narrative blog. And I was thinking about a book then, but not, you know, really not that seriously. And the idea with a narrative blog was it was pretty much largely online, though we repurposed some of it for the newspaper if it was something you could kind of grasp without following the whole story. And I expected probably a year at most and, I don't know, 50, 60 installments. The darn thing went like 3 years and almost 300 installments. And I had a lot of fun with it. But it truly became an avenue for more reporting on this. I mean, that's where a number of people who contacted me, again, from both sides of the law, so to speak, had seen this and learned of it and contacted me with insights. A number of people I met and that I used in the book.
What's an example?
Perhaps the thing I just mentioned that I can't tell who the source is.
Yeah, that you can't tell the source.
Or sources about, you know, the homicide of Ronnie Gibbons. Because again, there's this whole connection with Cape Vincent where his remains are found. That's probably the most prominent, that some of the stuff there came directly from people who had followed the blog. Law enforcement, I mean, some of it, you know, they were able to, you know, people who are on the scene at different parts were able to sort of elaborate and provide more details. You know, the quote you mentioned early on, you know, if Tom O'Connor isn't dead, he did it. Had it not been for the blog, and though that person, I think, was aware then I was writing a book, but he you know, knew from the blog, and with that person, there were more than one ultimately, but and told me that story.
Well, that's why, you know, if you remember Gary's work with Veronica Volk on Finding Tammy Joe, you know, as that podcast progressed, you know, occasionally you hear from people in the community, people with either ideas, sometimes pure conjecture, but sometimes information. And before I turn back to 7 Million, anything you want to update us on Finding Tammy Joe? Any news?
You know, it's Veronica and I were just talking about this the other day. There's still reporting going. I mean, it's interesting. That thing has had such great reach. I mean, literally, I think up to like, you know, over the 8 or so episodes, some of these audible multiple listeners, but like 500,000 listens. And I literally in the last month and a half or so there's some citizen sleuths out there who have been sending me stuff that's just tremendous work that I'm really hoping to follow up on. But it's still, and there's something about that podcast that it's still alive and well and still finding listeners and people still interested.
When it comes to what actually happened and where the money went and how the crime went down, well, Sam Miller tells you in his memoir,
yes.
Gary. When did his memoir come out? He wrote that when?
Late 90s, after he was out of prison.
He was quite a writer.
Yeah, Sam has been doing, he has a series of novels on a sort of a particular private investigator and some others. He's done a play, which was well-received about, and you could say, I think part of it, you can almost sense it's autobiographical, because he'd served time at Long Kesh Prison, which was just brutal, brutal for folks like himself.
By the way, back it up here.
Yeah,
tell us a little, Long Kesh, for people who don't know what it is, what was it?
Long Kesh was a British prison, which sort of became the center of holding of IRA prisoners and led, to, if you've heard of Bobby Sands and the hunger strikes, which led to 10 deaths, that's where that happened. And Sam was there at the worst of it. I mean, Sam wrote a memoir called On the Brinks, and researching his life history and his other parts of that, I mean, I have no reason to doubt what he writes about what he endured there at Long Kesh. The robbery he presents it in his book is complete hogwash. I don't need any qualifiers for that. I really don't. And I think, as I noted in my, I think he, what he believes to be noble reasons, and you can argue this, that he does not want to identify the people who helped him do the robbery. So he creates what is absolutely a ludicrous story about the robbery for his memoir.
You have tried to communicate with him over the years.
I did, and I think until I wrote that his book was partly hogwash, it looked like we might actually talk. I've had no luck since then.
Yes. Should have held your fire on that one.
I should have, yeah.
You had at least one email back from them a little bit, but not a lot of substance from
them.
Yeah,
there was one point where I said, look, Evan, and this is back before, this is years ago. This is back before Ronnie was found, before I thought about a book, before I was doing the blog. And this is when I was sort of on the hunt for Ronnie Gibbons. I said, look, I have some questions. And he mentions Ronnie in his book sort of prominently in some parts. I have some questions. Can I ask you? And he said, well, send them to me. I sent them to them. I never heard back. And then it actually was probably after that that I think when his book came out, I think I did write that the robbery story was pretty far-fetched and continued to say that if necessary. I mean, if it was part of the story I was writing as the years progressed.
Yeah, back in the blog, Gary mentioned that you got Sam's book, and the first thing you did is you skipped halfway through to start with the robbery.
Yes.
You found it to be hogwash, but then you went back and you read the first half, and you did find it to be compelling.
Oh, very, very much so. And there were parts of it that, as I was doing the research for my book, that I was skeptical about. And researched both. I mean, I filed freedom of information with Northern Ireland and got the history of his crimes. I've got newspaper articles from that era about some of Sam's crimes. He was very young when he went off to Long Kesh, and it basically backed up everything he'd written, and so that made me feel better about some other stuff in his book that I could not definitively prove, but at least the foundation of what he was writing made me feel better about some other stuff that I used in mine.
Some listener questions. Kirk says, am I confusing the Buy-Right Market heist in this one? Separate incidents?
Yes, that's the AMSA heist of 1990, November, $10.8 million. Yes.
Yep, so the AMSA was 3 years before, and that was the one that Gary did say in the book was pretty definitively bungled by the FBI. Getting the wrong guys, and
yes.
Yeah, so
I'm sure my FBI friends that are listening now are loving this if they're listening.
No, they're working. They're
in the middle.
David writes, I wrote my thesis screenplay on this robber. My brother was the arresting officer at the restaurant. Is there a movie planned?
Wouldn't that be wonderful? I have no plans, but if somebody comes to me and said, hey, I'm not going to say no, go away. Sam actually has some movie rights to his book. I don't know if that impedes my chances or not. There's actually some pretty serious folks that took the rights to Sam's book maybe a year or so ago, which I wrote about. The progress with that, I don't know.
Okay. Joel wants to know, did Felix take the case pro bono?
No, I don't believe so. Yes.
And Tim, I think this is Tim, says, I'm buying the book today. You had me after about 3 minutes.
Oh, thank you. I hope you still like it after 280 pages. Thank you. Yes.
Let me close with this, Gary, then. Have you heard from anybody, whether it's the Father Pats of the world or just people in the local Irish community who have asked you to reconsider, or at least say, you may not like some of what happened, but the cause of the IRA was just, you know, think about that. I mean, have they pushed on that?
Not really. And, you know, one of the parts of the book that I struggle with, and I still do, I haven't gone back and read it for a while. I'll read snippets of it, and sometimes, as you probably can relate, it's painful to
yes,
read, you know, because
yes.
You go back and say, oh my gosh, I could improve on that. And, you know, the Northern Ireland conflict is such a morass and so hard to get your arms around that I always felt that I wasn't really doing it justice in the book, but at the same time, I didn't want it to devolve in sort of into that,
yeah.
Sort of a revisiting of
the whole
issue.
It's not just a book about the IRA
exactly.
Or that conflict.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. No, I thought you did a very good job of sort of re-educating those of us who kind of long forgotten
yes.
Some of the details,
mm-hmm.
And I appreciated that. Is this the final word, though? Is $7 million the final word on what happened with Brinks, or do you think we're eventually going to get more on this?
You know, I think the odds on getting more about the money... nobody ever called me with that answer during the 3 years of the block are
probably not
slim.
Huh?
You know, yeah. Ronnie's death, perhaps, and as I think I note in the book at the end, you know, basically, you know, this is more than the end, to be continued, and perhaps it will be.
Gary Craig's book is called 7 Million, A Cop, A Priest, A Soldier for the IRA, and the Still Unsolved Rochester Brinks Heist. It is riveting. It is a fantastic read, we have a lot of books. I don't say that about every book we bring in, but this is just about as enjoyable as it gets. You can see Gary on Saturday at Barnes & Noble.
Barnes & Noble,
in Pittsburgh.
At 1. I'll be actually doing a talk there at 1 p.m. followed by signing.
All right, so talk at 1 p.m. followed by a signing. And is there something else that day as well?
I'm at the RIT Barnes & Noble at 4.
At 4 o'clock. So two events on Saturday. You can see Gary. Thank him for the work there. Thank you for coming in. Great fun.
Thanks, Evan. I really appreciate
awesome
it.
Awesome stuff. He also has a professional Facebook page. He doesn't know the address, but it's easy to find him.
Gary Craig Public Safety. That'll get
I'm
you there.
I'm hiring you a PR agent. Thanks to John Andrus, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk to you Wednesday on Member Supported Public Radio.